From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Two events have marked my life, really. And the first one happened on a Tuesday, September 11th, in 1973, when we had a military coup in Chile that ended a long tradition of democracy. It was a terrorist attack on a democracy sponsored by the CIA. And many years later, on a Tuesday, September 11th, there was the terrorist attack here in 2001. And these two events, the fact that they both happened the same day of the week, the same day of the month, and almost at the same time of the day.
Today, we'll talk with famed Chilean author Isabel Allende. We'll discuss two September 11ths and her latest book, My Invented Country. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The first meeting between the Israeli and Palestinian prime ministers since the beginning of the Intifada has come to an end. In the Jordanian port city of Aqaba, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon stood side by side with Palestinian Prime Minister Abu Mazen, President Bush, and King Abdullah II. In his closing speech, Sharon said, quote, "It is in Israel's interest not to govern the Palestinians, but for the Palestinians to govern themselves." He said, "A democratic Palestinian state fully at peace with Israel will promote the long-term security and well-being of Israel as a Jewish state." Sharon also pledged to begin dismantling some, quote, unauthorized outposts. For his part, Palestinian Prime Minister Abu Mazen called for an end to the armed intifada. He said, "We will exert full efforts to ending the militarization of the uprising. The armed intifada must end, and we must resort to peaceful means to achieve our goals." The New York Times reports Sharon's speech fell short of the sweeping remarks U.S. diplomats had drafted and then negotiated word by word with Israeli officials. He omitted any reference to ending Israel's occupation of Palestinian land and pledged only to dismantle settlements Israel considers illegal. In a bizarre twist, the Israeli government issued so-called clarifications to Sharon's speech even before he made it. His office said when Sharon referred to a Palestinian state, he meant one that met conditions he had laid down, such as being demilitarized and being the only home for Palestinian refugees. President Bush announced the U.S. will monitor whether the two sides fulfill their commitments under the so-called road to peace. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz reports President Bush waved his arms as he told reporters his aim is to keep the process moving like a cowboy on horseback herding cattle. Later, aboard Air Force One, sipping a Diet Coke, Bush said, quote, "I use the expression ride herd. I don't know if anybody understood it in the meeting today," he said. Back in Israel, some 20,000 settlers and their supporters protested against the peace plan last night in Jerusalem's Zion Square. And back in the occupied territories, Israeli troops shot a 7-year-old girl in the stomach during a raid. It was the third day running Israeli troops raided the Balata refugee camp and the city of Nablus. According to the Red Crescent, some 50 people have been treated for bullet and shrapnel wounds in 2 days. The Guardian of London reports many in the West Bank are looking at their television in astonishment that their prime minister met with Sharon. Today, June 5th, is the 36th anniversary of the Israeli occupation of the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. Local, national, and international groups are protesting the occupation today. Simona Sharoni is one of them. She is coordinator of the June 5th Coalition, professor at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, has just come into New York. She's executive director of the Peace and Studies Association. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Professor Sharoni. Can you tell us what you are doing today?
Yes, there are coordinated actions calling for an end to the Israeli occupation and for immediate deployment of international observers in Palestine. There are coordinated actions in over 25 cities all over the world, including London, Dublin, Israel, Palestine, the United States, and Canada. And if people want to find out what's happening in their town, they should go to www.endtheoccupation.org and look at what's happening around the world and what's happening in their own neighborhood and plug into some of those events.
And how many international observers are there still in the occupied territories these days?
There are actually no official international observers. There are members of international human rights groups, many of them that have restricted access to the West Bank, and very few are allowed into Gaza, and they're members of the international solidarity movement. The actions today are coordinated to support the international solidarity movement, which, you know, includes people that have put their bodies on the line and paid with their lives. They're in the memory of Rachel Coy and in respect of Brian Avery and Tom Handel, three members of the international solidarity movement who were targeted by the Israeli military forces while protecting Palestinians and preventing house demolitions and the daily practices of the occupation. It's imperative, and this is what we're calling for at the UN, both with the forum and with the vigil here, that the international community faces up to its responsibility to bear witness and protect the Palestinian population in the West Bank and Gaza.
I want to thank you for being with us, Simona Sharoni, coordinator of the June 5th Coalition. Rachel Corey's parents will be joining us tomorrow on Democracy Now! Rachel Corey was run over by Caterpillar Bulldozer. That's the corporation's name, Caterpillar, here in the United States. In Gaza, Caterpillar operated by the Israeli military. Bulldozer ran her over and then ran back over her, and she died. And as we continue with news headlines, Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz has publicly admitted oil was a central reason for the U.S. invading Iraq. Wolfowitz was addressing delegates at an Asian security summit in Singapore over the weekend. Asked why a nuclear power such as North Korea was being treated so differently from Iraq, where no weapons of mass destruction have been found, he said, quote, "Let's look at it simply. The most important difference between North Korea and Iraq is that economically we just had no choice in Iraq. The country swims in a sea of oil." Wolfowitz's comments were reported yesterday by German newspapers and then picked up by the London Guardian. These latest comments come after Wolfowitz told Vanity Fair, quote, "For reasons that have a lot to do with the U.S. government bureaucracy, we settled on the one issue that everyone could agree on, weapons of mass destruction." Meanwhile, the Pentagon's top policy advisor held an unusual briefing yesterday to refute accusations that the Bush administration doctored intelligence reports to justify the invasion of Iraq. Undersecretary of Defense for Policy Douglas Feith acknowledged he'd created a small intelligence team inside his office shortly after 9/11 to search for terrorist links with Iraq. But yesterday he claimed, "I know of nobody who pressured anybody." A U.S. soldier was killed and five were wounded early today when they were hit by a rocket-propelled grenade in Fallujah, Iraq. The assault came a day after more than 1,500 U.S. soldiers moved into Fallujah and surrounded areas in central Iraq. Their mission is to quell increasing attacks on U.S. occupying forces in the region. Anger in Fallujah grew in late April after U.S. soldiers fired on crowds of civilians, killing at least 18 people. Britain's Ministry of Defense is investigating the deaths of two Iraqi prisoners. It's the fourth separate inquiry into allegations of abuse by British soldiers. This news from Afghanistan. Afghan government officials say nearly 50 people have died in a battle between government forces and suspected Taliban fighters in southern Afghanistan. The AP reports seven government soldiers and some 40 Taliban fighters were killed. The deadliest battle since the Taliban fell comes as Afghan President Hamid Karzai prepares to meet British Prime Minister Tony Blair. He's expected to tell Blair that Afghanistan is nearly bankrupt. This news from Russia, a female suicide bomber today blew up a bus carrying Air Force service personnel near Chechnya, killing at least 15 people. Zimbabwean soldiers beat an opposition supporter to death yesterday as government crackdown intensifies on day three of a national strike aimed at toppling Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe. Police also raided a private Harare hospital yesterday, beating and arresting several patients, this according to doctors quoted in the Guardian newspaper. Opponents of Mugabe said opposition supporter Chichaona Kaguru died in the hospital after being tortured by Zimbabwean forces. And the UN-backed special court for Sierra Leone yesterday indicted Liberian President Charles Taylor for crimes against humanity during the civil war in Sierra Leone. The announcement set off mass panic in the Liberian capital of Monrovia. Thousands fled their homes. The city came to a halt. The charges were made public as Taylor is in Ghana for peace talks with rebel forces who've taken nearly two-thirds of Liberia and are now within a few miles of the capital. Prosecutors are calling on Ghana to arrest Taylor. The Guardian reports the timing of the indictment may be a politically motivated slap in the face to the peace talks mediator, who include South Africa's President Thabo Mbeki, Nigeria's Obasanjo, and leaders of Sierra Leone, Ivory Coast, and Ghana. Here in this country, Martha Stewart was indicted on charges of conspiracy, obstruction of justice, and securities fraud for a personal stock trade she made in 2001. She's pleaded not guilty and has vowed to fight the charges. Still no word on whether Ken Lay, the former head of Enron, will be indicted. And finally, a bipartisan majority of an important Senate committee indicated yesterday it would vote to overturn some of the media ownership rules adopted 2 days ago, reversing one of the most significant deregulatory steps undertaken during the Bush administration. The battle over the new rules, says the New York Times, which the rules narrowly adopted by the Federal Communications Commission along partisan rule lines, spilled into Congress, where the Republican commissioners who voted for them faced hostile questions from both Democrats and Republicans on the Senate Commerce Committee yesterday.
Rulers of the nations, as you fuss and fight over who owns this or that and who has the right to design, build, sell, and store and fire all the bombs and guns to defend your holy empire. There are children hungry, children sick and dying. There are mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers crying. They're only pawns in your play of power and corruption. Slowly starve them, your new weapon of mass destruction. And prove to me, America, that you care. And prove to me, America, you're aware. Who's dying for your freedom in this land? Who pays the cost for the liberties you demand? For freedom or our comfort and convenience.
Is it for freedom? Sarah Thompson here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, and it's great to have you back, Juan.
Yes, as I'm back from my leave from both at the Daily News and the time I've been away here, and hopefully we'll be here more often now that my work with getting ready for our big convention, the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, is largely completed. The convention will be here in New York in another 3 weeks, and now that a lot of the work around getting the journalist groups around the country to take stands on the FCC's recent media concentration decision is over. At least we've gotten through this stage of the battle. That even though we lost with the FCC, there's still a lot more battling, as you've been mentioned in your headlines, that will go on the part of journalists as well as civic and civil rights groups throughout the country to prevent further media concentration. Hmm.
As Michael Powell's father, Colin Powell, leads the invasion of Iraq, his son, Michael Powell, head of the FCC, leads the war on diversity of voices in the media.
Yes, and he won a temporary victory last week, but I think that the Congress is clearly going to get involved, so will the courts, and this battle is going to continue for many years to come. The important thing is that there is now a movement that is really developing in this country with a broad range of organizations around media democracy, and that's been the critical new element that hasn't really existed up until now.
So as president of National Association of Hispanic Journalists, it's not true that you're just spending more time on the golf links. I thought that's what presidents do.
No, I've never spent any time on the golf links. No.
Well, it's great to have you with us today for a very exciting hour that I've been looking forward to for a long time. And since my last interview, today, an hour with acclaimed writer, author, Isabel Allende. She joins us in the studio today. Isabel Allende is author of 8 books, 2 memoirs. She was born in Lima, Peru in 1942. She traveled the world as the privileged daughter of a prominent family. Her uncle was the Chilean president, Salvador Allende, who was killed in September 1973 when the Pinochet forces rose to power in a coup backed by the CIA. Afterwards, her family fled to Venezuela when Allende continued to work as a journalist for a newspaper in Venezuela. Her debut novel in 1982, The House of the Spirits, chronicled 4 generations of a Chilean family through the tumult of that country's political history. It's a history that is intertwined with Isabel Allende's own. Her latest book is called My Invented Country. It's a reflection on exile. It traces the author's personal history, bookended by 2 defining moments in her life: the 1973 assassination of her uncle, and the September 11th attacks on the World Trade Center. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you. I'm very pleased to be here.
Well, it's great to have you with us. And I thought if we could start off by just hearing you read from your latest book, My Invented Country.
Until a short time ago, if someone had asked me where I am from, I would have answered without much thought, nowhere, or Latin America, or maybe in my heart, I'm Chilean. Today, however, I say I'm American, not simply because that's what my passport verifies, or because that word includes all of America from north to south, or because my husband, my son, my grandchildren, most of my friends, my books, and my home are in Northern California, but because a terrorist attack destroyed the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center, and starting that instant, many things have changed. We can't be neutral in moments of crisis. This tragedy has brought me face to face with my sense of identity. I realize today that I am one person in the multicolored population of the United Nations, of North America. Just as before, I was Chilean. I no longer feel that I am an alien in the United States. When I watched the collapse of the towers, I had a sense of having lived a nearly identical nightmare. By a blood-chilling coincidence, historic karma, the commandeered airplane struck the U.S. targets on a Tuesday, September 11th, exactly the same day of the week and month, and almost at the same time in the morning of the 1973 military coup in Chile, a terrorist attack orchestrated by the CIA against a democracy. The images of burning buildings, smoke, flames, and panic are similar in both settings. The distant Tuesday in 1973, my life was split in 2. Nothing was ever again the same. I lost a country. That fateful Tuesday in 2001 was also a decisive moment. Nothing will ever again be the same, and I gained a country.
Is it Isabel Allende reading from her new book, My Invented Country, A Nostalgic Journey Through Chile, joining us here in our firehouse studio just blocks from Ground Zero.
Yes.
your thoughts as you come to New York, you now living in California?
Well, I have been several times in Ground Zero, and it is shocking to see this that emptiness, if the eerie feeling of all those spirits there, and all that was lost, the pain for the people who died, and the reminder of all the people who die in that way all over the world every day. I think that what happened that day was that for the first time in the United States, people have had the feeling of vulnerability that people have had for centuries in the rest of the world and still do.
We're going to break and then come back with acclaimed author Isabel Allende.
Salado e increíble que se me alberga en el pecho, qué país salado e increíble que se me alberga en el pecho, va preso entre un olor a tostadas y a raíz de violeta con naranjas, va preso entre un olor a tortillas y a raíz de violeta con
País Azul, Guadalupe Urbina, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our guest for the hour is Isabel Allende, perhaps most well known for her book House of the Spirits, but has written many books since then. Her latest is My Invented Country, A Nostalgic Journey Through Chile. Juan?
In the section you quoted, and obviously the spark for writing this book, is this macabre coincidence of the fact of September 11th and what it means to you versus what it might mean to the rest of us now. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that, about on that day when you realized, you must have realized within a few hours or instantly, the significance of that day in Chilean history, what your thoughts were. And obviously this has had an enormous impact on your consciousness and your search for your country, in essence, over the years. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I live in Northern California, and it was very early in the morning for us over there, 3 hours earlier. When the towers were hit, I was in the shower, and the phone rang, and it was my mother from Chile, and she was crying on the phone. And I thought that she was crying because it was the anniversary of the military coup in Chile, a day that we honor every year, because it really changed our lives forever. And it split our family in ways that have been very dramatic, because we have all, since then, we have never been all of us together again. And this was 30 years ago. So I picked up the phone, and my mother said, no, it's, turn on the TV, something horrible has happened. And I turned on the TV and I saw the towers. I just couldn't believe it, because it was also a Tuesday. It was the same time of the day. It was September 11th. And my first thought was that it was like historic karma, something that all the wrong we do comes back to us. And all the good we do also does. And when I said in my book, My Invented Country, that I gained a country that day, was because for the first time, I realized that I belonged in the United States. I cared deeply for what was happening. And I shared the feeling that people had at that moment, for maybe for the first time in this country, the feeling that something could happen and we could die. In the United States, people have a sort of optimistic, arrogant notion that life is safe, that our children will live better lives than we do, that we will always have enough to feed them, that that things work. And September 11th was a reminder of how people live in the rest of the world, with a notion that we have to celebrate every moment, because most probably it won't last.
Isabel Allende, can you go back, because we are almost at the 30th anniversary of the coup in Chile. Go back that 30 years. How old were you? Where were you at that moment?
I was 31 years old. I was a journalist in Chile, living in Santiago. I think I had a very happy life. I was writing theater, directing a children's magazine, working for a women's magazine. I had the feeling that I belonged in a community and that everything that happened in the country mattered to me and that I was involved in everything. And then that day I got in my car and drove to my office, and I realized that the streets were empty. It was very early in the morning. And there were groups of stranded people waiting for the buses that never came, and military convoys, and an eerie feeling of silence and emptiness in Santiago. And we had been hearing about the possibility of a military coup for months. So I thought to myself, oh, maybe this is a military coup. But I had no idea what that could be. I drove to my office and I found it closed, and there was someone there that said, no, there's been a military coup, turn on the radio. But I didn't have a radio in my car. It was a very funky car. And so I drove to the house of a friend who had a telephone, because I wanted to know what had happened with my kids that had left for school in the morning. And my friend said that her husband, who was a teacher, had left very early in the morning to go to the school. The school was downtown Santiago, very close to the presidential palace. And I said, I'm going to pick him up. And so I drove to downtown, and I was stranded there. And by an incredible coincidence, I was able to see the bombing of La Moneda, the presidential palace. And what happened then? And the images were, in a way, similar to what I saw on TV when the World Trade Center was attacked. The airplanes and the fire and the panic and that feeling that something unexplainable had happened, because for us in Chile, the idea of a military coup was unthinkable. We were the strongest and most solid and longest democracy in the continent. It was as if, I try to explain this to Americans. Imagine that all of a sudden the armed forces would attack the White House and kill the president and eliminate Congress and freedom of the press, and established censorship, and the citizens would not be allowed not even to gather, to be together, or to talk. Everything would be censored. And if you're a dissident, your life is at stake. And that would go on for 17 long years. People cannot imagine that in the United States, but that happened in Germany. It happened in Spain. It happened in Italy. It has happened in places as democratic as Chile. So it can happen here, it can happen anywhere. And it is a terrible feeling.
And what was your understanding at the time of the role of the United States?
We suspected that the CIA had been involved. Allende had been denouncing for a long time that that was happening, but nobody quite believed him, because the opposition owned most of the media. And so there was this campaign against the government, portraying Allende as paranoid and a drunk. Actually, Allende did not drink. And so when it happened, we couldn't believe at the beginning how much the involvement of the CIA was. But then the first people who were tortured in Chile, and that was the very first day, we had torture centers and concentration camps all over the country. And the first people who were tortured needed interpreters, because Chilean police, secret police, did not know how to do it. And sometimes they needed an interpreter, and they were using American devices and Brazilian torturers that they had flew from Brazil. So it was a very hard time. In the years to come, it has been proven that the CIA was deeply involved.
And of course, for those of our listeners who are not familiar with Chilean history or not old enough to recall the coup, the Pinochet coup, the Allende government was the first socialist government ever democratically elected, and the sense, as you're saying, that the Chileans had that you couldn't have a military coup. Obviously, when it came to these growing conflicts, class conflicts within the society, anything is possible. And we're seeing even now, for instance, the election of Lula in Brazil. But Brazil has a longer history of military coups, and yet the people keep trying to elect governments that are more representative. But as you say, at any given moment, if the conflicts in the society, particular classes of people want to don't like what's happening. You mentioned the press in Venezuela right now. The press is playing a critical role in trying to formulate public opinion over their elected president. And the lessons of Chile for Latin Americans today, who are attempting now in various countries to have more representative governments?
Well, it's a different time. This happened 30 years ago in times of Kissinger and Nixon, at a time when we had the Cold War, and for the United States, the possibility of a new Cuba anywhere in Latin America was a real threat, because there were guerrilla movements all over. The idea of revolution was something that sparkled the imagination of all the young people. And Salvador Allende was the first democratically elected Marxist socialist president. And the United States decided that that was more dangerous than having a revolution, because that would really spread like an epidemic all over the rest of Latin America. So the idea was to destroy Allende's possibility more than him. It was the idea of destroying the idea of a socialist government by sabotaging economically and politically and socially the Chilean experiment. And they sort of achieved it for 3 years. But in 1973, in March, we had parliamentary elections in Chile. And instead of losing votes due to the economic crisis, the government gained votes. So at that point, the Chilean opposition to the government, with the help of the CIA, decided that the only way that they could stop Allende was with a military coup.
How well did you know your uncle? How well did you know Salvador Allende?
He was a member of an extended family, and I knew him, but I was not close to him or intimate with him in any way. My father left when I was very young. I was 3 years old, and I never saw my father again. The only person of the Allende family that remained close to my mother was Salvador Allende. So I would see him in picnics on Sundays sometimes, family reunions, weddings, that kind of thing.
And what do you believe happened that day in the palace? What happened to your uncle?
I don't know. There are two versions. One is that he was killed, that he was shot by a lieutenant, and there is a name of a person who supposedly killed him. There are other versions that he committed suicide, and I don't think it really matters, because when he went to the palace in the morning, the day of the coup, he had decided that he was going to die there. No one was going to take him alive, and he was not going to go into exile. I had been having lunch in his house 9 days before. And it was a time when the right-wing press, El Mercurio, was publishing huge titles calling the president to renounce, even suggesting the possibility that he should commit suicide, as President Balmaceda had done before, many, many years before, to avoid a civil war. And I heard Allende say, I'm not going to renounce. I'm not going to leave the palace until my term is over or dead. And I thought that it was like so solemn a speech for a family lunch. And I thought it was like the kind of thing that you say for history, for the future, or something like that. And I felt a little embarrassed. I think he knew very well what was coming. And that is why I think that that day, and I have talked to people who were there with him, his best friends, his doctor who was there with him, and they say that he was going to die anyhow. He was never going to surrender.
We're talking to Isabel Allende. She is the acclaimed author. Her latest book is My Invented Country, A Nostalgic Journey Through Chile. She's joining us in our Firehouse studio here on Democracy Now!
To get back to some of the of your memoirs in the book, I was struck by your concept of My Invented Country, that a country is, while you spend a lot of time describing the geography of Chile, the towns, the vastness of it, and introducing Americans, many of whom don't know much about Chile, you then really try to delve into how a person imagines their own country and the relationship between the geography and the process of migration and feeling isolated or alienated within the United States to the point where you have developed your own country within. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
But isn't that what happens always? Even if you live in a country, you have an idea of the country that may be totally different from the idea that somebody else has. I'm sure that a farmer in Montana has an image of the United States that is quite different from a person who lives in Manhattan or in Northern California, as I do. But also when you are forced to leave for whatever reason, you carry with you memories, and then when you go back and you confront them with the real country, they don't match most of the time because you have changed, the country has changed, and also because memory is not reliable. If you and I witness the same event, we will probably remember it in different ways, or maybe one of us will not remember it at all. So in a way, all memory is subjective. History is subjective too, because who writes history? Always the winners, always the white males. So it's always a slanted version of whatever happened. Do we really know what's happening in Iraq today? What is our image of what's going on there? A sort of video game that we watch on TV. But the image that someone who is there has of the conflict may be absolutely opposite of what we think is going on.
Isabel Allende, My Invented Country, A Nostalgic Journey Through Chile is her book. Before that, Portrait in Sepia, before that, two memoirs. One of them, a painful story about your daughter, Paula, and how she lived and how she died. And I'm wondering if, as September 11th for so many people, though you've experienced two of them, brought that back for you as we lived in that loss and suffering.
My daughter, Paula, had a condition that should not be fatal, called porphyria. And she had a crisis in Madrid in 1991, was taken to the hospital, and there was negligence in the hospital. She fell in a coma. There was negligence in intensive care, and she had severe brain damage, which has nothing to do with her condition. And they covered it up for a while. Eventually, I found out, and I disconnected her from the respirator. And then she started breathing. And at that point, I brought her to the United States and took care of her at home. And she died exactly a year later. It was a very hard time. A horrible time in which I had the feeling that I had to throw overboard everything because the weight of living was just so hard. And as I did that, I got rid of things I learned a lot. I was liberated of many, many things that we carry and that we don't need in life at all. And when she died on December 6, 1992, I felt that I was a new person and maybe a better person. I had a strength that I did not have before, and I was cleansed by pain and grief. And since then, my life has been, in many ways, a better life. I carry the sadness of her loss, but I also carry her in ways that I didn't before because I took her for granted. And in my life, I realized that it's when you lose something, when you really learn how valuable it is.
You also talk about the times you have had to leave your country, your place, a person like your daughter, completely, and what that means to keep starting over.
That seems to be my fate, to lose, to be separated, and to gain back other things that I was not expecting, great success and great losses. So I know that it's like a roller coaster and I shouldn't cling to anything or anybody. That doesn't make me indifferent. It makes me just as passionate about the things I believe and the things I want to do. But I don't condition my well-being or my happiness or my strength to having things. I know that nothing is permanent. Change is the only constant in our lives.
We're talking to Isabel Allende. Her book is My Invented Country. We're going to break and then ask Isabel if she would mind reading another piece from her book, A Nostalgic Journey Through Chile, My Invented Country. Stay with us.
Which piece?
La paz esté con nosotros. La paz esté. La paz esté con nosotros, la paz esté con nosotros, y con nosotros siempre, siempre esté la paz.
You're listening to Democracy Now. That was Los Sonidos de San Lucas by La Paz.
And that's Juan Gonzalez. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guest is Isabel Allende. Her latest book is My Invented Country, A Nostalgic Journey Through Chile. Yes, she is the author of Eva Luna and House of the Spirits and so many other books. She's written 8 books, 2 memoirs. And we're seeing if she will read another passage from her latest book. Isabel.
Maybe the beginning. I was born in the years of smoke and carnage of the Second World War, and the greatest part of my youth was spent waiting for the planet to blow apart when someone distractedly pressed a button deploying atomic bombs. No one expected to live very long. We rushed around, swallowing up every moment before being overtaken by the apocalypse. So we didn't have time to examine our navels and take notes as people do today. In addition, I grew up in Santiago, Chile, where any natural tendency towards self-contemplation is quickly nipped in the bud. The saying that defines the lifestyle of that city is, shrimp that doses is shrimp on the platter. In other more sophisticated cultures, like those of Buenos Aires or New York, a visit to the psychologist was thought to be a normal activity. To deprive oneself of that attention was considered evidence of a lack of culture or mental deficiency. In Chile, however, only dangerously disturbed patients visited a psychologist, and then always in a straitjacket. But that changed in the 70s, along with the arrival of the sexual revolution. One wonders if there is a connection.
Isabel Allende reading from My Invented Country. As you go back and forth between two countries, saying that you could almost finally absorb the United States after September 11th, 2001, what has that journey been like for you? And maybe you can talk a little about your history. Growing up in Chile, exiled in Venezuela, and then that decision to come to the United States, the country that had overthrown your own country.
Well, I didn't come to the United States following the American dream. I didn't even know what the American dream was. I was passing by. I had been married for 25 eternal years, and I divorced my husband when I was 45. My mother, ever an optimist, said, you're going to spend the rest of your life alone. But as it happened, I came to the United States in a book tour, and I met a guy in northern San Francisco, and I fell in love with him, and decided to spend a week with him and get him out of my system. And this was 16 years ago, and I'm still here. I forced him into marriage to get a green card, and and we've been together, and it's not been bad, you know. I'm all for mixed marriages. Willie and I don't have much in common, but we sort of like the fact that we have so little in common, and we are always discovering new layers and layers of culture in the other one. And I think I came to love the United States because of him. He was the door, the person who introduced me to this country. And it's always amazing for me to observe him and see the difference between a person who has been born and lived all his life in a place and a person like myself who has always been forced to leave. He has a certain, he has certainty, he's sure of himself, confidence. He can open an aspirin bottle, he can order by mail, he can pay taxes on the phone, he can do things that are unbelievable. When I open a faucet, I never expect hot water to come out of it. I expect something to crawl out of it, but not hot water. And this certainty that he has about life is so reassuring and so wonderful.
Is your mother still your editor?
My mother is not exactly my editor anymore because she's 82, and I have to send her the manuscripts, clean manuscripts. I have to take out all the sex and everything that has to do with the Pope. And then I put it back after she gives me the corrected manuscript.
You talk in your book quite a bit about your husband, Willie, and about marriage, especially toward the end, and the compromises or the flexibility that is necessary to maintain a good marriage.
Are you looking for advice, Juan?
I could always use a little.
I think that especially when it's a mixed marriage, as ours is, you need to compromise a lot because you don't know the clues and the codes of the other one's behavior. For example, one of the things that I never could quite understand was Willie's relationship with his children and his family, and eventually I had to let go because I have all this Chilean thing, you know, that you just honor responsibility, punctuality, that love and structure and rules will solve everything, and it doesn't work that way. On the other hand, he has to compromise with all my Chilean things. One of them is that I put all the breakable things like the glasses and the china always on the lower part of the cabinets where he can't reach. He's not very flexible. He's 6 feet tall, and he has to lie on his back to take out the dishes every night. So, but that is because in Chile we have earthquakes. So in Chile we always have the breakable things lower down so they don't break on an
earthquake. You have them in California as well. You have told the story of how you wrote your first book, but I just think it's a very touching and instructive story of sticking with it. Can you talk about how you started House of the Spirits, and also if you still start your books on the same date of the year?
Yes.
Even My Invented Country?
All
was
my
it
books.
January 8th?
January 8th. It was on a January 8th, 1981, when I was living in Caracas in Venezuela, that we received a phone call that my grandfather was dying in Chile. And I adored that old man. I had been raised by him. But I couldn't go back to bid him farewell. So I started a letter for him that I think that in my heart I knew he was never going to read, because he was already very, very sick. And the letter, as soon as I started writing, my intention was to tell him, you can go in peace, because I remember everything that you've ever told me. And that's why I started writing the first anecdote that he ever told me about Aunt Rosa. But as soon as I started, I realized that it was not a letter. It was something else. And I just didn't worry what it was. I just kept writing and writing. And I wrote every night in the kitchen, in our apartment. And by the end of the year, I had 500 pages, and it was something weird that it didn't look like a letter, but it didn't look like a book either. It was a very dirty manuscript. My mother read it and said, I think this may be a novel. But then we sent it to different publishers and nobody wanted it. It took a while. But it was interesting to see that when the book was a book and it was published, I felt that my life changed. I did not quit my day job, but I felt that I had a voice.
Which publisher took it?
Somebody in Spain, Plaza y Janés. They have been my publishers since then.
Were you surprised when you heard?
I was surprised that I was published, and then I was surprised at the fact that in few months the book had been bought by publishers all over Europe, and it was translated to several languages, and it became one of those rare sudden successes that that very seldom happen with books.
Can you talk about women's power?
I come from a family of very strong males. And therefore, the few women that we are in the family, we have to be very strong to survive and to put up with the men. For some reason, maybe because I did not have a father, although I had some strong male figures in my life, in my books, the feminine characters are much stronger than the males. And I like to write about women because I think that they're very complex and interesting. And their motivations are usually much more interesting to me than the motivations of power or greed or pride that usually drive men. I'm not trying to dismiss men. I like them a lot, and I can use many of them almost all the time. But but I do like women, and I know them well, and I've been working with women and for women all my life, so I think that it's easier for me to write about them.
We're talking to Isabel Allende. Her book is My Invented Country, A Nostalgic Journey Through Chile. Do you think that by writing this book, you can leave Chile?
No. No, I think that by writing this book, I can clear out the confusion that I have in my head about where do I belong. I was always torn between Chile and the United States. Now I'm not. I think that I can have a foot there and a foot here and have the best of both places, and my heart is not divided. It just grew bigger.
I'd like to get back to some of the eerie resonance of September 11th. Another figure that had a return role after September 11th was Henry Kissinger,
which is amazing to me.
For a while, Bush named him to do the investigation of the results of September 11th. I'm wondering when you heard that, and of course Kissinger ended up having to resign because of his many conflicts, but when you heard that Henry Kissinger was being put in charge of
investigating. I thought it was funny. I thought it was one of those ironies that are so awful that they are even funny. Henry Kissinger, in many places in the world, people think of the possibility of asking for Henry Kissinger's extradition so that he can go to trial for crimes against humanity in places like Central America, like Chile, and many other places. So the fact that he would be in charge of that commission is just eerie and stupid.
Maybe he would have a flashback, get confused, and think he was supposed to be investigating September 11th, 1973.
Yeah. Well, he will have to respond sooner or later to those charges.
And what has happened to Pinochet? First held under house arrest, finally he gets back to Chile, then he's considered too old and sick to be tried. Has it, though, had an impact?
Yes. In 1998, when Pinochet, when a Spanish judge asked for Pinochet's extradition, Pinochet was then in London, and the British arrested him until this situation was cleared, and he was arrested for several months in London. Things changed immediately in Chile, because for many years after Pinochet left power, there was a tacit agreement that the military would not be touched, that we would not talk about what had happened, and Pinochet was still a respected figure. When this happened, however, it was as if the truth that had been right under the surface all of a sudden emerged with an explosion, and the media and everybody started talking about things that we hadn't talked before. So although justice has never been made and won't be made, although the people who should be punished will not be punished, and Pinochet is under a sort of house arrest, but he enjoys all the privileges of a free man, and he's not too sick to go to trial, that's not true. We know now what happened. I don't think that there is any Chilean anymore who can deny the atrocities that were committed. Some people can still justify them and say, well, we needed to do that because the alternative was worse. Some people may say that, but no one can say that it didn't happen.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, and let people know that you'll be traveling on the 9th to Washington, D.C., to Olson's Bookstore in the National Press Club, and to Phoenix, to Changing Hands Bookstore, to Berkeley, California, to Cody's Books. Nice to know you're going to be visiting independent bookstores, and have also always supported and celebrated independence of thought. Isabel Allende, her latest book, My Invented Country, author of The House of the Spirits, of Love and Shadows, Eva Luna, The Stories of Eva Luna, The Infinite Plan, Paola, Aphrodite, A Memoir of the Senses, Daughter of Fortune, Portrait in Sepia, and City of the Beasts. Thank you for coming to our studios here.
Thank you
at
very
Democracy
much.
Now. If you'd like to get a copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Our website, where you can hear or see this interview and also go back to our previous interview with Isabel Allende, is www.democracynow.org. And our email address is mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Elizabeth Press. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer with help from Rich Kim. Again, our website, www.democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.